Hello, welcome to the show called The Environment. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with SunSounds of Arizona. I'm going to be reading articles from the Sierra Magazine, the Spring 2024 edition, 2026 edition. And this first article is entitled Higher Ground. The subtitle is An Ambitious Plan for Managed Retreat is Stalled as Seas Keep Rising. It's a story by Bryce Covert, C-O-V-E-R-T. Here's what he wrote. I met Bob Rulli, that's R-U-L-L-I, on a cold, rainy morning at Jameel Park in Warren, Rhode Island. Wearing a yellow raincoat and duck boots, he walked me around ground zero for the town's flooding problems. The park's baseball fields and basketball courts that abut Belcher Cove, its marshy shoreline blends in with the grassy yards behind a string of houses. During major storms and king tides, these yards become an infinity pool, he said. The road that runs through the park often ends up completely underwater. And Market Street, which is adjacent to the park, floods out at least once a month. He said, quote, this is a ticking time bomb. People are going to be displaced. Where are they going to go? Unquote. According to the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, this whole area will be under at least 3 inches of water within the next 45 years. In 75 years, Jameel Park could be under a foot of water, and that's on normal days. If a 100-year storm were to hit Warren today, seawater and storm water would quickly flood most of the town, costing it nearly $9 million. As the planet warms, driven largely by human activity in the form of burning fossil fuels and deforestation, and industrial agriculture, the rising seas are slowly coming for coastal communities like Warren. While he was Warren's town planner from 2017 to 2023, Rulli took on the challenge. He was the brains behind an ambitious proposal called Market to Metacom, a form of managed retreat, the planned relocation of buildings and communities at risk from sea level rise. If the project was implemented, the town would buy out the homes and the businesses lining Market Street in phases, beginning with those most at risk, and eventually empty and demolish all 400 structures in the flood zone. The land would then be returned to its natural state to support ecosystems while protecting the rest of the community from flooding. The plan also calls for developing new affordable housing on higher ground along Metacom Avenue to the south, which is currently dominated by nondescript strip malls, and offering those units to displaced residents. He said, quote, probably the two most difficult topics to talk about in this environment right now are climate change and housing, unquote. And it's what makes Market to Metacom different. Few, if any, managed retreat plans have tried to tackle both issues at once. Experts on managed retreat give the idea high marks, but it's still only a plan on paper. Market to Metacom is stalled for a lack of money and leadership. Many residents feel they haven't been properly consulted, and many have grown restless, whether from impatience or outright opposition. Mario Canario has lived on Market Street his entire life. He grew up in a two-story house on Belcher Cove. His father, a Portuguese immigrant who was used to living by the ocean, built the house on a concrete foundation and constructed a stone wall facing the water. Once Canario had money of his own, he purchased a house directly next door to his father's. So for a long-time coastal resident like Canario, There is no question that seas are rising. He has a front row seat to a changing climate. Photos on his phone capture scenes from around his neighborhood at different times of day, each telling a version of the same story, flooding. In one image, a patch of lush grass in his backyard is indistinguishable from seawater, which, during king tides and big storms, flows right up to the bottom step of his deck. In the photo, only the fence around his concrete patio and the pole holding an American flag poke above it. Even on sunny days, the water comes inches away from his yard. Canario's family never dealt with this kind of flooding when he was growing up. If Warren takes no action, studies show that the town will lose 57 housing units to the tides, displacing 86 people, within the next decade at a cost of about $9 million. Market Street, one of three evacuation routes out of Warren, will begin to flood daily. Child Street, one of the other evacuation routes, will follow suit. By the year 2050, 121 units will disappear. By 2100, most of the buildings along Market Street corridor will be damaged, and the cost will balloon to $85.8 million, and more than 800 residents will be left adrift. The town stands to lose tax revenue if nothing is done. There are 700 homes and 30 businesses in the area, including a few restaurants, an auto body shop, and a dry cleaner. Few of them are elevated. Most have basements. Many have been in the same family for generations and are not covered by flood insurance. The premiums are simply unaffordable. It's also far more expensive to pay for emergency services for flooded buildings than to implement a strategic, proactive plan that progressively relocates those buildings and their residents to higher ground. Flooded buildings mean dealing with mold and chemical leaks at a time when contractor costs for emergency services are climbing. Canario hasn't been waiting for the city to act. He built shelves in his basement so that nothing sits on the ground, and he raised his washer and dryer a foot off the floor. He moved his furnace and electrical systems into first-floor closets and installed both a sump pump to get water out quickly and a water alarm that notifies him if there's a flood. He plans to buy a camera that will face his yard so that he can check remotely if water is encroaching on his property. These are what he calls pre-game modifications to prepare for a changing climate. They aren't cheap. Canario said, quote, pre-game cost money. Not everybody has that extra buck, unquote. Canario is a couple of years away from retirement. He's not sure if he wants to stay in his house or leave for higher ground. He already had to sell his childhood home, his father's castle, because the flood insurance got too expensive. Canario said, quote, I think of my kids. Do I leave them a house that's going to be taken away? Unquote. Now, under Market to Medicom, at-risk residents would be offered voluntary buyouts in phases over 50 to 70 years, with the goal of purchasing 383 properties by the year 2100. The estimated cost for the buyouts is $138 million. Most streets and utility infrastructure would also eventually be removed, not just the housing structures. This approach would, in theory, prevent checkerboarding when some people leave and some stay, making it harder to provide services to those who remain. After the buyouts, the land would be converted to wetlands, allowing it to absorb water and help protect the higher parts of the town. Meanwhile, the displaced residents would need a community to receive them. On Medicom Avenue, that's a four-lane highway, an Ocean State job lot discount store sits at the back of a massive parking lot with significant redevelopment potential. Part of Rooley's plan involves changing the zoning of that area So development is guided by building use and neighborhood character rather than constrained by residential or commercial classification. The plan aims to boost density and affordability while also creating a desirable neighborhood to live in. Architecture firm Union Studio drew up renderings that envision a new performing arts center on the job lot parcel with open public spaces alongside multi-story mixed-use buildings. The community would be walkable and include better stormwater infrastructure and a safer road design. Kate Mashad, who was Warren's town manager when Market to Medicom was conceived, worked with Ruley on the concept of pairing flood response with the redevelopment of Medicom Avenue. The town, their thinking went, would recoup some of the money spent on buyouts through higher tax revenue. A redeveloped Medicom Avenue could generate an extra $1.2 million a year. Mashad said, quote, "We were really thinking, what makes Warren a wonderful place?" Unquote. The aim was to hold on to that. Then Mashad said, quote, "We didn't even want to talk about taking something away without adding something that could help to mitigate the social impacts," unquote. Ruley and Mashad searched the country for models of how towns were responding to sea level rise, other places that had brought residents out of dangerous areas and offered them a new place to live. There were few examples. They realized their plan was unique. A.R. Siders, co-director of the Climate Change Science and Policy Hub at the University of Delaware, said that in convincing people to move out of a flood-prone area, there are push and pull factors. The Market Street buyout is the push. Redeveloping Medicom Avenue is potentially the pull. Quote, "You can push people out, say, don't live here. You can also pull people out, say, hey, this new place has an amazing walkable neighborhood. It has a cool park," unquote. To help fund the buyout program, Ruley applied for a grant from the Environmental Protection Agency's Southeast New England program in early 2020. SNEP, S-N-E-P, which I guess is Southeast New England Program, loved the proposal, seeing it as something that, if successful, could be replicated in other places, and awarded the project $90,000. The grant money helped turn an idea into an actual plan. But the scope and ambition of the project has proved challenging to implement, as has the process of getting residents to buy in. A botched rollout did not help. Soliciting community input from the get-go is crucial to the success of a major climate adaptation plan like Market to Medicom. That's not what happened in Warren. Ruley publicly launched the plan in February 2020, just as community engagement events moved to Zoom after COVID hit. Ruley admitted that the outreach efforts were anemic. Residents who were later surveyed said they felt left out. Many complained that they learned about how Market to Medicom was developing only from news reports. Others have simply rejected the plan. Stephen Pimentel owns an auto repair shop directly across from Jameel Park. He said, quote, "I'm totally against it. I'm not going anywhere," unquote. He believes the plan is cover for an effort to force people out of their homes via eminent domain. Even those sympathetic to the plan have their doubts. In November 2024, at one of Warren's monthly Health Equity Zone meetings for people concerned about climate change, multiple attendees told me that Market to Medicom was not popular. They were worried about the current effects of climate change. What does the plan have to offer them if it has a 50-year horizon? What about fixing roads that have been eaten away by floods and fortifying against the tides with seawalls now? What about renters, who make up about 40% of Warren residents? What happens to them if their landlords take buyouts? Louis Rigo, a Warren Town Council member, said at the meeting that he was very concerned about Market to Medicom. The riverfront area is already flooding, he noted. Grants haven't come through. He addressed the room with a rhetorical question to which no one had the answer. Quote, "What is option B?" Unquote. Well, last year, the University of Rhode Island began partnering with Warren and two other low-lying communities, one near Dover, Delaware, and another on Edisto Island, South Carolina, on their plans for sea level rise. The university team plans to offer Warren leaders tools for generating more community engagement. It will also survey residents to find out what flood mitigation strategies they prefer and what they're willing to pay for. The idea is to give each community concrete tools to guide its decisions on how to deal with a changing climate. What Warren residents have already made clear, said Emmy Achida, chair of the university's Environmental and Natural Resources Economics Department and the principal investigator for the project, is that they, quote, do not want another study of a study, unquote. Ideally, the University of Rhode Island project will keep the base issue of flooding top of mind for Warren residents while Market to Medicom is on hold. Ruley said Mashad had hoped that Market to Medicom would attract more funding, and that hasn't panned out yet. Warren did receive a $155,000 state grant to analyze existing infrastructure around Medicom Avenue, but it failed to secure an $18 million grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which would have allowed town leaders to start setting up the buyouts for Market Street. Nor did it get a grant from the Department of Agriculture to address storm and tidal flooding. If Warren leaders wanted to move forward, they could rezone Medicom to spur private development or set up the bones of a buyout program. But there is currently a leadership vacuum. The town has gone without a town planner since late 2024. Market to Medicom will require residents and their leaders to act collectively and plan for the future. Whether they will, especially before the next major storm strikes, is unclear. Politicians are not typically rewarded for plans that don't come to fruition until years or decades after they are in office. But still, Market to Medicom has inspired other plans like it. Mashad has received calls from town planners and officials from outside Rhode Island. She said, quote, the smallest town in the smallest county in the smallest state, and people are reaching out to us to find out what we are doing, unquote. And that was the article entitled Higher Ground, and the subtitle is An Ambitious Plan for Managed Retreat is Stalled as Seas Keep Rising. This was written by Bryce Covert for the Sierra Magazine. Our next article is entitled Winds of Change by Dana Drugmond. It was a crisp, clear November morning when I boarded the Rhode Island Fast Ferry, a catamaran called the Julie Lay. Our destination, South Fork Wind, America's first commercial-scale offshore wind farm, about 20 miles southeast of Block Island. The 132-megawatt project, developed by the Danish energy firm Ørsted, came online in early 2024. South Fork's generation capacity from 12 turbines is nearly five times that of the Block Island Wind Farm, whose five turbines, also developed by Ørsted, have supplied 100% of the small community's electricity since 2016. Those pioneering projects are helping drive a nationwide energy transition, replacing polluting power sources with clean, renewable ones. Yet wind power is facing enormous headwinds from a federal administration intent on shutting it down. Amber Hewitt, senior director of the National Wildlife Federation's offshore wind team, who joined the trip to South Fork, Amber said, quote, it's been a tough year for offshore wind. This is still worth fighting for, unquote. Well, as the climate crisis accelerates, the biggest greenhouse gas emitting nations will need to hasten their move away from the very thing driving it, fossil fuels. Wind, like solar, is a critical part of that transition, and the two are among the cheapest and most scalable ways to cut energy-related emissions. According to federal estimates, the carbon footprint of coal-fired energy is 90 times greater than that of wind, while the fracked gas footprint is 40 times bigger. When large-scale wind farms are up and running, feeding energy to entire communities, they reduce our dependency on or completely displace dirty resources like methane gas and coal. About 45 minutes into the trip, a series of wind turbines come into view on the horizon, part of another even larger offshore wind farm called Revolution Wind, which Ørsted is developing slightly northeast of South Fork. The 66-turbine, 704-megawatt site is expected to come online in the second half of 2026, delivering carbon-free power to more than 350,000 homes in Connecticut and Rhode Island. The project has overcome stop work orders issued by the Trump administration, first in August and again in December, when construction was already 87% complete. After passing Revolution Wind, we arrived at South Fork, its towering, three-bladed structures jutting from the ocean like marine skyscrapers. Our boat glided close to one of the turbines, whose rotating blades were remarkably quiet, making a gentle swishing sound. Wind speeds were relatively light, and yet the blades were still spinning. In ideal wind conditions, a single rotation of the blades can generate enough electricity to run an average U.S. household for a whole day. Each of South Fork's turbines is connected through an undersea cable to an offshore substation, where the electricity is converted to a higher voltage and then transmitted to shore via a 78-mile-long export cable. This substation, built by more than 350 workers from three states, was the first one constructed in the United States for an offshore wind farm. More than 1.5 million hours of union labor went into building South Fork Wind, which created over 1,000 jobs. Construction was completed in spring 2024, and by the following July, the farm was fully operational. It is now delivering clean, renewable electricity to New York's Long Island grid to power the equivalent of 70,000 homes. South Fork's turbines are spaced 1 nautical mile, that's a little over a mile, apart. This, quote, according to Zayac, said, this creates a good straight transit line for vessels and others to safely navigate through the wind farm, adding that the site is completely open for both transit and fishing activities, unquote. And underwater photos and benthic or seafloor monitoring indicates that marine life has been flourishing. With the turbine foundations serving as artificial reefs, some participants on the tour have even spotted a dolphin. It was a beautiful day to be out on the water. As we made our way back to shore, I snapped a photo of the offshore turbines from the rear of the vessel. An American flag attached to the stern billowed in the wind. Christian Roseland, co-director of Climate Action Rhode Island's Yes to Wind campaign, she said of this tour, quote, it was a stunning, aesthetic, and visual experience. The turbines looked to me like a livable planet, unquote. And that was the article, Winds of Change, by Dana Drugmond. Wow. This is quite a picture. It covers two pages from left to right, and it's entitled Picture, Big Picture, Climate-Wise, photo by Tanya Hoopermans. Think of almost any human invention, and chances are that you can find something similar in nature. Case in point, American crocodiles. They rely on bony, armored plates that, like solar panels, absorb sunlight. But instead of generating electricity, the plates help regulate the croc's body temperatures. These reptiles often live in mangrove forest, which were storing more carbon per acre than rainforest long before the advent of direct air capture technology. The picture she took is a close-up of an American crocodile's face in the water, and you can see on the left-hand side his snout, or her snout, and the teeth, and it goes all the way over to the right side of the page, and there's the eyes on top of the water, but the body is underneath the water, and all we can see are the snout to the eyes and maybe, oh, a few inches beyond it, but it takes up, it's a close-up, and it's a big close-up. So that was The Big Picture, Climate-Wise, photo by Tanya Hoppermans. Well, we're out of time, so I'm going to have to say goodbye. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with SunSounds of Arizona. You have been listening to articles read from the Sierra Magazine, the Spring 2026 edition, and the show is called The Environment. Have a great week, and I hope you keep on listening. Bye for now.